This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Nick Stansbury, Head of Climate Solutions, and Court Gilbert, Senior Credit Analyst. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Morning.
Today, in addition to surveying key market trends, we're going to pay special attention to the commodity complex and the energy transition, a long-term theme of critical importance, not just to investors, but to the entire world. So with no further ado, Sonia, let's start where we always do. What do investors need to know about the latest virus developments, the health of the global economy, and the state of financial markets today?
Thank you, Max, and good morning, everyone. Yes, let me kick off with obviously a quick view on virus developments and probably even more so on the successful rollout of vaccination programs globally. Because clearly, although we still have worrying trends with regards to new infections, in particular in Europe, it's very clear that the successful application of vaccines is now showing noticeable impact, in particular with regards to hospitalization rates and death. And that clearly allows countries now to think forward and think about how to ease restrictions. Most noticeably here in the UK, we have had obviously a big day on Monday where pubs were allowed to reopen at least for serving some beer outside. So that has a huge impact. And obviously, not surprisingly, there has been a lot of attention on the economic forward-looking outlook. And we have seen a flurry of upgrades quite aggressively, you know, moving forwards, revising up growth forecasts, most noticeably in the US. I mean, if I look at our own assumptions back in September 2020, forward-looking to the fourth quarter of 2021, we were at a 4.8% growth rates. Moving fast forward to today, we are approaching around 7.5%. So you see there's been a real impact on, you know, on our own growth expectations, and we are not alone with that. There's even some obviously street forecasters that are still ahead of us in terms of the expectations. The main driver behind this clearly has been predominantly fiscal response. We have talked a number of times in our podcasts and webinars around the twin stimulus arising from monetary and fiscal measures. And clearly, the monetary support is still in place and is a real backdrop for markets. It's stabilizing, providing liquidity. And clearly, everybody is expecting this to stay in place until the foreseeable future. But more importantly, as we have seen, again, more announcements around fiscal measures and fiscal support. And I think the US in particular is really showing the way here, where we had more announcements coming from the Biden administration. We know there was the American Rescue Plan, which was passed in March and is a $1.9 trillion package. But then on the back of this, there has been further talks about the so-called American Jobs Plan, which is targeted around another $2.25 trillion, and is obviously focusing on infrastructure and job creation. And then there's a third element, the American Plan. And again, we're talking about potentially $1 to $2 trillion. And that clearly is at the bottom of the much revised forecast for economic growth. And I'm obviously now moving forwards to look at markets. Not surprisingly, this has not gone unnoticed, and risk assets obviously have performed quite well on the back of this. Now, we have seen that risk assets obviously have anticipated a lot of this. And we have talked last time in the last episode of LGIM Talks, particularly around the bond market and what investors should expect from bonds going forward. Because clearly with where bond yields are and where spreads are, it is quite difficult to see how bonds can really be a meaningful contribution to your return for going forward. And likewise, we did pay quite a lot of attention on how investors should think about the diversification benefits and the hedging benefits that you usually expected, particularly from your government bond holdings. Now, inflation clearly, alongside much revised growth forecasts, logically, you have seen a lot more debate around the path for inflation. And clearly, this is the key ingredient to our expectation around central bank policy. And just over the past couple of days, we had a few inflation indicators coming in above expectations. And obviously, we have seen quite a lot of movement in bond yields already. Now, we have said before, and we stick to it, that we need to expect a base effect kicking in towards the middle of this year, simply because if you think about the 2020 situation around the mid-year point and the peak impact from the lockdown measures, clearly, once you open up, and it looks like the US and the UK are well underway towards this opening up, then clearly inflationary numbers will exceed on the upside. There is a base effect. And if you then add the expected, you know, excess demand, pent-up demand that will potentially be unleashed, then we need to be prepared for, you know, some quite big jumps in inflationary measures. Now, this will not, you know, worry the Fed and other central banks too much, because that is much expected by now. It's more about the longer term trend, and when clearly we will see a kind of sustained throughput in terms of pricing pressures. And that obviously will be something that we are watching very carefully, because that will determine very much whether the current dot plot put forward by the Fed actually is a realistic one or not. Equity markets, as discussed, clearly should be the main beneficiaries. The rotation in markets is ongoing. What started back in November last year, when we had the first real push towards fiscal stimulus and the US talking about the 1.9 trillion package, we are now obviously seeing a continuation, because with that level of economic recovery underway, clearly earnings growth will be a much broader based phenomenon this year, and hence will support a larger range of sectors. And not surprisingly, it's benefiting the early cyclical and those sectors that have been most beaten up throughout the pandemic. As you said before, Max, today we want to spend more time and focus on the commodities complex, because clearly, as we have seen, not only with economic growth being revised upwards, but inflationary outlook being revised upwards, not surprisingly, the commodity complex has been one of the beneficiaries. And clearly, we have received lots of questions from our clients on how to look at this. And hence, with that, I would like to hand back over to you.
Well, thank you for that overview, Sonia. Let's turn to quartz now. Commodity prices have had a strong run from their pandemic lows before leveling off in recent weeks. What's the outlook from here? And are we on the cusp of a new super cycle?
Yep, thanks, Max. You know, I think the environment that Sonia described, where we have accelerating and improving growth prospects combined with accommodative monetary and fiscal policy, really is kind of a sweet spot for commodities. So it's not surprising to see the complex overall doing quite well. In the early part of the year, as you alluded to, the super cycle term does seem to have made a bit of a comeback. And for me, I'm a bit hesitant to use that term, because I think it evokes images of kind of the last major cycle, which involved the largest country on the planet rapidly industrializing and urbanizing, driving significant demand that kind of lifted all boats. I think that what we're seeing in the commodity space going forward, in some ways, is more of a supply side story, where you've had, you know, 5+ years now of limited investment in adding new supply. And you don't really have that same massive structural demand driver across the entire complex. I think the next cycle is probably going to see more differentiation between the commodities. One place where we do see some more, you know, quote, super cycle type elements is in some of the base metals that are seeing structural demand improvement from the electrification of the vehicle fleet and of the energy complex. And we kind of circle copper there as one that really stands out to us. You know, some of the you know, nickels and cobalts of the world, in terms of absolute benefit from demand, you know, it is larger, but also see greater risk of technological substitution there. And we have seen some false starts in some of those commodities, as the supply response has been able to, in many cases, be, you know, a bit stronger than anticipated. In copper, you know, there really is kind of a dearth in new projects kind of going out to the middle of the decade. I think it is a bit premature to say that we're on the cusp, you know, just because if you look out to 2023, you do have a few key projects coming online that should lead to more balanced markets and potentially even slight surpluses in that year. But beyond that year, going out to 2025, you know, the projects are smaller, more expensive, and generally concentrated in ever riskier jurisdictions. So there's a lot more supply risk as we get to the middle of the decade and beyond. At the same time, we should see that accelerating demand in electrification. So as I heard one analyst describe it, we're kind of in the rolling foothills leading up to the mountain. And I think the next few years could be characterized by some volatility there. But the structural outlook on that commodity in particular does look pretty favorable to us in the medium to longer term.
Right. It's a lovely landscape-based image to look at the current market situation. Looking at another area of the complex, how might Iran rejoining the nuclear deal impact the oil market? And is this already being priced in?
I think it is to a large extent being priced in. I think that there's a tendency to look at, Iran, obviously one of the largest producing countries within OPEC. I think there's a tendency to look at this as kind of a sort of Damocles hanging over the market's head, and that, a potential negative catalyst that could kind of upset the more favorable market balance that we've seen. The fact is, when you kind of look back to the previous nuclear accord, it did take some time beyond reaching an agreement for Iran to actually bring the production back into market and ramp up exports. Kind of on the order of 9 months. Reportedly, they have built some inventory, so could do that a bit more quickly this time. I think another key question is what's going to be required of them to resume an agreement and get the sanctions lifted. We have seen estimates that if the requirement was for them to get their uranium program back in line with the previous agreement, would take them something on the order of 4 months to achieve. So I think that there is some timing elements in there that we need to bear in mind. In terms of the volume impact, the guidance that Iran has given is that they could bring exports back up to 2.3 million barrels per day by March of next year if the sanctions are lifted. They're no longer publishing official export numbers. And if you look at, the Bloomberg numbers or people that track this, it's kind of in the low 200,000 per barrel area. But there are tanker tracking organizations that say that the real amounts could be, 700,000 barrels, some saying even as high as 1.5 million barrels. So I think there is a bit of uncertainty as to what we're actually getting in the market now from Iran, and then consequently what that differential could look like. My expectation is it's probably smaller than people suggest. To me, the bigger issue is the cohesion of OPEC Plus. The messaging out of OPEC Plus has been that if Iran were able to come back into the market, that the cartel would be able to accommodate that. To me, that's really the key question. And I think that if Iran does come back, it probably provides them more impetus to be a bit more cautious on adding barrels back to the market from elsewhere. So I'm a bit less concerned about that than maybe some others in the market.
Right. Well, and this is a really good point to look at the theme of the energy transition and turn to you, Nick. What does your modeling tell us about the progress or lack thereof that companies are making to align with the objectives of the Paris Climate Accord?
When we try and track the progress of something like 3,500 companies globally to measure what you're talking about, we would see that only a very small fraction of those, maybe 10 to 15%, appear to be decarbonizing at a fast enough rate that we think we could consider them genuinely aligned to a 1.5 degree net zero type of outcome. So clearly, the vast majority of companies are behaving in a way that's aligned with the rate of progress that we observe the world making, which is, quite frankly, too slow a rate of progress. We know that last year was a tremendous blip. We saw last year a reduction in global greenhouse gas emissions as a consequence of COVID. This is probably larger than anything else we've ever seen in terms of a single year-on-year improvement like that. Something like 2.5 billion tons estimates vary as a reduction. But much of that, probably most of that, is going to have been an entirely one-off effect that gets unwound very, very quickly. And it's helpful to stop and realize that the scale of the reduction that we saw last year is in the order of, not precisely, but in the order of the scale of reduction that we need to see every year for the next 10 to 15 years for us to start to build some confidence that we are on track for that sort of an outcome. So whilst it's disappointing that the companies that we track don't appear to be proceeding at anywhere close to fast enough pace to consider them aligned to a net zero type of climate outcome, that's not surprising given the context that we don't observe that rate of change occurring at a global level either.
Okay, so disappointing but not surprising. So what risks are involved for the companies that are failing to align, and are markets correctly factoring in these risks?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's really hard to work out precisely what is and is not priced into markets today in terms of climate risk. I think for many analysts who work in that area, that's really sort of the biggest question I think that remains to be answered is a really robust way of trying to work out that problem. How much of this climate uncertainty do we see reflected in markets today? But we think when we stop trying to do that from the top down and do it from the bottom up, i.e. when we start comparing the way the market values two companies that are quite closely related to each other, but have very different climate risk profiles due to things about those companies that are kind of relatively innate to them. So for example, an aluminium company that has a deeply coal-fired electricity generation base that powers it, and an aluminium company where it's being powered by hydropower, for example. We see maybe some difference in valuation, but nowhere near the extent to a difference that would be implied if the market were to be discounting in that sort of 1.5 or 2 degree type of climate outcome. So I think that tells us that whilst the market is not pricing in nothing, it is not pricing in anything close to all of the risks that are involved. Again, that's probably what we should expect to see, because I think it's highly uncertain that the market should be pricing in a climate outcome that it isn't at all clear that the world is heading towards. So it would actually be a surprise to us, given that we don't think the world's on track for a 1.5 degree outcome, if that was what the market was pricing in. That said, I think it goes beyond just a question of fundamental risk for these companies. If as investors, we look at where the biggest trend in terms of forward-looking fund flows is, it is increasingly into strategies which are seeking to align with the Paris goals. And as these flows accelerate, we think there is an increasing risk to companies, not that they see climate risk per se start to get discounted into their share prices or into their credit spreads, but they just start to see a progressively disadvantaged cost of capital, that it becomes harder and harder over time for companies that are not contributing to the Paris goals, that are heading off in a direction of travel that is totally societally unacceptable and at an increasingly sort of level of magnitude to investors, that they just struggle to access capital. So at higher and higher costs, they are less and less favored. There are fewer and fewer buyers for their shares. And that we just start to see this slow, gradual, but probably inexorable difference in valuations and multiples and share price performance between those companies that are and are not aligned with the Paris goals. And actually, the scale of that effect might turn out to be just as big or potentially even bigger than what would happen to those companies if the market were to really price in a 1.5 degree type climate outcome, given the nature of their businesses.
Well, that's a fascinating insight and leads very clearly to my next question to you, Sonia, which is, how are we as investors approaching climate-related risks and opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know everything that Nick has just said tells you how uncertain that the situation still is. And I think we have to accept as well that this clearly is a topic that has seen a huge level of acceleration through 2020. And if you look at the level of public interest now towards this topic, we have to consider that this has now seen a meaningful shift. Every central bank around the world has climate change now as one of their top priorities. Every regulator around the world will look at this and will obviously ask not only asset managers, but likewise asset owners to up their game and to establish the right framework. And clearly, we should not forget, it's COP26 this year in Glasgow, and hence, obviously, the level of attention, the expectation around countries making announcements, companies making announcements is clearly a given. And with that, you know, obviously, everything that Nick has just said, we have taken away to make sure that we have a thorough and in-depth understanding, because as Nick has made very clear, it is not a precise science as of today, but it is to establish an understanding on how the price discovery mechanism will eventually take the available data. And we have to assume that data will be enhanced over time and that we will get more data points, that there's greater clarity of the direction of travel, and particularly if we include obviously what countries, policymakers, and governments will tell us. And as such, that we have to assume that the price discovery mechanism will be better in pricing this. And so this is really the attempt that we have taken forward, that we said it has to be an integrated part of the analytical process, right? So it is really about understanding, you know, if I look at Cort and the sector he's covering, a fundamental understanding how well equipped a company is on its journey towards a Paris alignment, and whether, you know, the plans that have been put forward are really realistic, and that we think we can obviously put a tick in the box and say we can support this company, and we think it is one of the relative winners and well prepared on its journey. Because that, in a way, then obviously should lead what Nick has described to a way of market differentiation, because the more, you know, asset managers and analysts will move in that direction, the better we have to assume that price differentiation will occur. And that clearly is then how we say and claim this is the reason why we do integrate, because we think you can no longer separate that part, that those risks and opportunities from the overall assessment of a company. So in order for us to deliver for our clients with regards to the risk and return objectives, that has to be a fully integrated part, because otherwise we might well miss out in what will be a major shift within markets when we come to the point where there's greater clarity on relative positioning of individual companies, individual sectors and regions. And clearly, I think is something we are immensely proud of, the progress we have made to date.
That's absolutely right. And I would just point our listeners in the direction of our recently published active ownership report available on our website, which gives lots of detail on exactly those processes that Sonia has just described about integration. Cort, returning to your earlier remarks about commodities in general, how is the global fixed income team positioning to reflect the market outlook?
Yep, sure. So, I mean, I think one of the challenges in fixed income is taking the market outlook and translating it into what it means for balance sheets, credit metrics, and ultimately credit spreads. So for the miners, even though they are in this kind of, you know, nice place right now with CapEx low, commodity prices high, generating a ton of cash, a lot of them have already done a lot of the deleveraging work that kind of needed to be done in the wake of the last cycle. So when you look in the higher quality end of the spectrum, companies are running with well under a turn of net leverage, in some cases even running net cash. So in a lot of ways, there's kind of only one direction to go from here in terms of balance sheets. I think that we could see an uptick in spending on both organic CapEx and potentially some M&A transactions in the sector this year. Companies are just very cash rich. There are a few idiosyncratic examples kind of further down the quality spectrum where the change in commodity prices has really just changed the credit story in terms of their ability to deleverage more rapidly. And that's kind of the first call on cash for some of those companies. At the same time, the spreads have already kind of moved to reflect those stories and done so pretty quickly. So we're a bit more neutral in the metals and mining space with a bias towards some of the higher quality names at the minute. I think this is also a year where we could see some additional supply that could provide more attractive entry opportunities into that story. In the oil and gas sector, actually a bit more constructive from a credit perspective. There was a raft of issuance from the sector last year as they tried to right size their sources and uses after the COVID shock. But a lot of these companies have embarked more aggressively on their decarbonization journeys. CapEx is still low, with an ever greater share going to the low carbon businesses. But with oil prices in kind of the $65 range for a lot of these companies, this is a bit of a sweet spot where, you know, they're able to meet their capital commitments and their commitments to return cash to shareholders while at the same time managing the balance sheet. And for many of these transition plans, kind of the first order of business is delevering the balance sheet and reducing net debt. So in that sector, if we can kind of sustain this level in oil prices, I think we could see some deleveraging play through this year in that sector. So we're a bit more positively inclined there.
Thanks, Court. And Nick, before we finish up, are there any myths or misconceptions that you'd like to dispel about the energy transition?
We've talked at length about some of the things that we think some people get wrong when they think about this subject. And whilst I'm not sure these necessarily fall quite into the category of myths per se, we think that there are still a number of objections or pushbacks that sometimes raise their heads when we're talking about this subject matter with other investors. One of those things is that the energy transition is easy. In other words, all we need to do is just stop spending money on drilling new oil and gas wells and start spending more money building more wind turbines and solar panels, and this problem will be fixed. And clearly, we know, the evidence tells us, it's really clear that that's not the case, that the energy transition is complicated, that it is disruptive, that it's highly challenging, and that it is, in terms of the speed and magnitude of the change that is required, absolutely unprecedented in a historical context. So that's probably the first, is continues to be that this is easy, or maybe not easy, but this is relatively uncomplicated, an issue to fix. It's not. And the other way of looking at that issue of complexity is to think about it in the scale of what happened last year as a consequence of COVID. COVID is, I don't know whether it's a one in 100 year type of situation, one in 200, one in 50, we can argue about that. But it's clearly an extremely unusual set of circumstances for the world to go through, where we effectively sort of shut everything down, send everybody back to their homes and tell people you stop flying, you stop driving your cars, and we shut down huge quantities of industrial activity. And in the context of that sort of unprecedented shutdown of the world of transportation, we saw a reduction in global emissions of a couple of billion tons. Now, a couple of billion tons is both huge a number and a tiny number. It is huge in that it's we've almost never seen it before. I mean, I say never with some quotes around it, because you can come up with numbers if you measure the start and the end at different points. But if you think about it, sort of year-on-year reductions, it's a remarkably large number. And yet, that scale of reductions, 5-6% type reduction year-on-year, is the sort of thing we need to do every single year, year after year after year, for somewhere between 10 to 15 years, before we can start to relax into the idea that we're making real progress towards a net zero outcome. And so, I worry that people may look at what has gone on last year and start to say, see, we can do it. We're making progress. Because actually, our research tells us that big economic recessions tend to lead to a slowdown in progress towards these sort of societal objectives, not an acceleration. And that happens through sort of two axes. The first is that as consumers become more price sensitive, typically, they start to make shorter term rather than longer term decisions. And that means that you underinvest in energy efficiency. And of all of the levers that we have to pull as a world, energy efficiency as a lever is probably the biggest one and is the most underappreciated one. And yet all of the research, all of the data that we see suggests that energy efficiency improvements are slowing down and at a scary rate. And so that's the first thing, is you start to see price sensitivity of consumers. That tends to lead to higher discount rates in consumers' minds, shorter term decisions, undervaluing energy efficiency, putting off decisions that lead to that genuine sort of energy efficiency improvement, and a slowdown in rate of progress. The second troubling thing is that governments everywhere, their balance sheets may have been in trouble before this, they are now in desperate trouble. The rate of government indebtedness and the squeeze on government finances everywhere in the world is enormous. And whatever room there was for government-led subsidy to support the energy transition, a lot of that room has, in our view, been squeezed out. In other words, we think that what we've seen over the last year probably lifts some of the onus that would have sat on government-type public participants and is going to end up shifting the burden even more squarely onto the shoulder of investors. In other words, if governments have less money to spend on this, we're going to have to do more of the heavy lifting. In other words, the role of investors, in our view, is a consequence of COVID in terms of the significance of the impact of the decisions that we make in terms of the way we allocate capital towards delivering an acceptable climate outcome, has stepped up a big notch as a consequence of COVID. Because the less money that governments have to do and have to spend on this, the greater the level of international competition and rivalry, decreasing the ability of governments to cooperate and collaborate as a consequence of that rising pressure, the pressure that is going to increasingly build on consumers and potentially ever more so as tax burden rises, that leaves very few places to hide. And that thinks that if the world is going to, leads us to think that if the world is going to deliver an acceptable climate outcome, anywhere close to that 1.5 degree net zero type outcome that we are all so desperately striving towards, it is what investors do, and what investors do sustainably and over the long term, drive outcomes. And that for me is both exciting and also really scary.
Right. Well, you've been very clear on the role of investors and the fact that there is absolutely no room for complacency on this issue. Sonia, we've covered a lot of ground today. What are the key takeaways for investors? And is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, thank you, Max. And I think let me try and bring it all together, because clearly what Nick has just described is one of the key elements to consider in terms of the long-term structural shifts and what this means, obviously, for investors and in investment opportunities. I think if you think back the way we started, it's clear the economic cycle is really very, very positive, and probably in our overall kind of asset allocation context, it is the most positive component. We are seeing, obviously, lockdown measures being lifted and the expectation for a demand-led cyclical recovery for the second half has led to this massive uplift in terms of economic forecasts. Now, we have to be very careful. Even if this looks very, very positive, it does not have to translate into a equally positive market rally and market returns, because we know markets have taken a lot of this already and have discounted a lot of the positive news already. Valuations are at best neutral. You find pockets. I think we've highlighted credit and credit spreads and how tight they are. We've looked at some areas of equity markets and valuation levels you find there. So a lot of the good news has been discounted already, though clearly with that level of strength in the economic cycle, we have to assume that earnings growth will come through, and hence you will see ongoing support for markets. Now, within risk asset classes, it's very clear, and I think today's episode again has shared a lot of good insights in terms of how investors should think about these structural shifts and how to identify investment opportunities. Now, climate change clearly has seen huge attention globally, and it's been one of these accelerating themes. And I hope we made it very clear not only how important this will be going forward in identifying relative winners, but clearly how difficult this will be as well, because this whole journey is fraught with uncertainty and depends on a lot of stakeholders to get it right. So evaluations not as supportive, and clearly, you know, finding relative investment opportunities is a very important one. Now, what we haven't touched on today is the more systemic risk. We know that clearly there is a lot of question marks on how central banks will deal with the inevitable uplift in inflation. They will be relaxed about the immediate uplift and the immediate jump in inflationary pressures. But obviously, I've highlighted the programs that the US administration is planning. And clearly, that level of firepower inevitably will lead to the output gap being closed very quickly. And hence, obviously, price pressures can emerge far more broadly across the US economy. So how, you know, when will the Fed allow financial conditions to tighten? And as we know from prior episodes, that is very critical for markets and for bond markets in particular. Second, the US-China relationship. Again, we know that obviously it took a bit of a back burner all throughout the year 2020 because of the pandemic, but it's very clear that this will re-emerge, and as such, you know, in the context of systemic risks, is something that we need to have a close eye on. And then likewise, obviously, as Nick has already highlighted, you know, in terms of the fiscal support that we're currently seeing, and that clearly is very welcome and needed to allow, you know, economic recovery to be sustained through the immediate cyclical uplift this year. But clearly that has had huge pressure on budget deficits, global indebtedness of governments, and the question obviously how this will be, you know, dealt with in the future, and which economies will be best placed to develop economic growth that is self-sustainable and will hence allow, you know, budgetary, you know, discipline to be re-embedded further down the line. So I think this is where we are right now. We're still positive overall, but we make clear differentiations on what the moving drivers and catalysts are and what we're looking at in terms of our positioning. We are very much focusing on long-term structural change. We, you know, ESG and climate change clearly is one of them, but you know, the way we are working, the use of technology, the use of data, and clearly, obviously, the impact of policy measures, be it fiscal or monetary, clearly are other long-term drivers we're looking at. We still have a preference for equities because clearly in a backdrop like this, equities is the risk asset class that should look the most favorable. But it's, as I said before, it is not just a broad-based equity exposure. It is linked to all the structural drivers we've identified, and hence we're positioning those in a very clear and distinct way. Let me finish off really by saying that we hopefully can share more of these insights through our Elgin Talk series, and that hopefully that we can share what the kind of structural, you know, interesting opportunities are that we are seeing. But clearly with the way we have looked at commodities and climate change today, hopefully shows you how we are aiming to embed this in our investment process and hence make sure that we are picking the relative winners on behalf of our clients.
Thank you, Sonia. Finally, before we head off, I would just like to ask everyone on the call, as we are all based in the UK today, how you've celebrated the easing of COVID restrictions. I'll get the ball rolling and say, as you can all see, I've had a haircut and I've also joined a new gym. Sonia, have you done anything?
Not yet, but clearly priorities are hairdresser over the pub. So that will happen tonight to finally have my hair cut. But I think it's always very important to get priorities right. Pub is next, potentially.
Absolutely. Court?
No, as you can probably tell, I'm still rocking my home haircut from the last lockdown. So I'm probably still a few weeks away from that, but eager to get back to the pub as well. And I think for me, you know, kind of getting on a train and getting out of the city for a bit is kind of something I'm really looking forward to. So that's probably hopefully not too far away.
Right. And Nick?
Well, as a father to young children, our sort of big celebration and unlocking has occurred a few weeks ago when we sent our children back to school. So we're sort of in recovery from the hangover caused by drinking a bottle of champagne a night for about a week as we celebrated what is hopefully the permanent end to the great homeschooling experiment in our house. We really hope never ever to be repeated ever again.
Well, that's a great point on which to end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Court, and Nick, for your time today. And thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. Our next edition of the CIO call will be in May. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates via our social media channels on the LGIM blog and, of course, here on LGIM Talks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, lgim.com.